This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Dr. Mark Kermode. Good afternoon and happy Easter.
Happy Easter, although I have to say it's an Easter that's lacking in caffeine because the coffee trolley isn't there. And I usually, as everyone knows, I usually come in and I give you a cup of coffee and then you're in a good mood and you sort of like me for the next day. But there's no caffeine has
no
come
drugs.
With me. So I'll be very interested to see how this following hour pans
out. It's one of those bank holiday things. Staff will keep having the time off.
I know. And can we, because we have been neglectful recently, say hello to Jason Isaacs?
Hello to David Morrissey. Hello to, and also Fairport Convention.
Members of Pentangle.
Focus.
Kenneth Branagh.
And who's the other one who gets a mention? Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
Likes to be said hello to. Kevin Canterbury.
Yes.
I'm on my way now to the cinema to see Game Plan with my 10-year-old daughter and her friend. Should myself and my 13-year-old son watch it with them or take in 10,000 BC, 10,000 years BC?
Yeah, well, you see, you weren't listening last week, which I said, because I was away the week this came out, I didn't see Game Plan, and I asked for any reviews to be sent in. So, in fact, what you
could do
is...
just sorted out and gone and
No, because there's like 10 films out this week.
So answer to Kev is, dunno.
No, the answer to Kev is, please go, see them, send in a full report and see me after class. As far as 10,000 BC is concerned, I mean, it is a plodding donkey of a movie.
Well, we'll get there in just a moment. By the way, you can still watch... you'll probably have to go to YouTube to see it. You can still see our heroic efforts going around the quad
at
Eton. Yes,
my heroic effort. With some trailing and cheating
ran around together. In fact, as a number of people have pointed out, particularly A. Hunt in Chester. Simon, I've just watched the running film review from last week. Has anyone pointed out to you that you had the outside of the track consistently and therefore ran considerably further than Mark? And that's true. If you watch it, I might have cheated at the end as I just... nip round a quick pillar, which you didn't notice. But I actually... So I think I ran about 4 or 5 miles to your 2.5.
I think you probably did. I think I had a walk in the park and you were completely, fully justified in cheating for charity, mate.
I think that's right. And one of the comments posted underneath the film, as you scroll down, you see a lot of what people have said about it. Someone who enjoys the name Scrubby66. Kermode in sandals, Mayo cutting corners, no Exorcist references. Surely this is the death of narrative running.
Very good.
Which I like.
We were on Pick of the Week. Did you know that?
On Radio 4.
On Radio 4. Pick of the Week. Somebody just played it to me, and it is the sound of two men running out of breath and a Radio 4 presenter laughing at us.
Funny that.
But in a nice way.
Steve in Brotty Ferry. Good afternoon, Simon. Before you and What's-His-Name start going all gooey about The Princess Bride again, I'm not sure that was on the list.
No.
Why don't you tell your public how brilliant the book is? Your kids are about the same age as mine, and mine loved it when read to them. Better than the film, Dad, was the verdict. It's good for adults too. I don't think I've ever read it.
No, I haven't. I would be astonished if it is better than the film. I mean, it's such a great film. I don't know how much of the film is lifted wholesale from the book. Does the book have all the stuff in it about the kids saying, is this going to be one of those kissing stories? Which is
probably not.
You know, that's such a wonderful refrain.
Dan Bowen in Manchester, just listening to the latest podcast, the sporty one. Can I just say, after several years of listening to yourself and the good doctor, it's the first time I've ever heard him pause for breath while talking about films. In fact, scratch that. It's the first time I've ever heard him pause for breath while talking.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work.
But what is impressive, and if you're going to pull the, ooh, I did the outside run...
A listener did.
Can I just say, yeah, and I did all the talking. Because you did...
As normal.
You said you went at number 8, and then I went... And then you went at number 7. And this is the worst of it, you had the audacity at some point to go, God, it's really hard work, all this talking. It was like, yeah, all this talking that you're not doing...
Well, it's not my job to do
No,
it.
That's the point. That's the point. Chris, so they gave me the inside lane because I was doing the talking bit.
Chris M, when you say hello to Jason Isaacs... Oh, we missed this. When you say hello to Jason Isaacs...
Do it again.
Many congratulations should go to him and Phil Davis for The Curse of Steptoe. Which is the best TV, says Chris, since Life on Mars. That was on BBC 4 this week, given their biggest ever ratings. He was brilliant.
Yeah, I have recorded it. I haven't seen
fantastic.
It yet, but I heard him talking about it on the show and it sounded very, very interesting. Did you see it?
Yes, absolutely.
Was it fabulous?
I thought it was brilliant. Absolutely extraordinary. So when you get to do that...
This weekend.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
Box office top 10. By the way, reviews coming up. A lot of holiday movies to mention. For example, The Spiderwick Chronicles, mm-hmm. Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who, Anything else we should mention, which we'll definitely get to?
Well, we're definitely going to do the orphanage.
Depending on how much wittering we get to do.
No, we're definitely going to do that, and we'll probably do Meet the Spartans.
Number 10, there will be blood.
Yeah, I mean, it's on the way out, finally, but I'm hoping that everybody who ought to have seen it has seen it. It is something you need to see in the cinema.
On that subject, Tom in Gothenburg. Mark will be pleased to hear that I saw There Will Be Blood in Gothenburg's Bürgerkungen cinema in a salon that can only hold 100... Oh, it can hold 100 people, but there were only 7 people in it.
Fantastic.
I had a row to myself.
Brilliant.
And at least 6 free seats in front and behind. Even so, my enjoyment was still disturbed by an odd father and son combination, 4 rows ahead, who chatted throughout the film. No. I say odd because the 40-something father, in inverted commas, was seemingly letting his not-yet-15-year-old son smoke afterwards. They were the sort of people who have to say, when they're looking at a screen, look, it's a car. I know those people. Seamus, I could go and see it again, but then you lose the impact of knowing what happens. What to do? By the way, Mark's pronunciation of the Swedes, Max von Sydow, is spot on.
Thank
and a lot
you.
Better than Brian Blessed's on the Flash DVD commentary, where he rhymes it with Sideshow. Or that's Tom in Gothenburg. Anyway, that's at 10. Hannah Montana or Miley Cyrus or the best of both worlds concert.
I think the full title is
this title,
Hannah Montana / or and Miley Cyrus in the best of both worlds concert tour - 3D.
Too much punctuation
title. The fact is, if you're going to see a 3D concert movie and you have to choose between this and you two boring the pants off everybody with their sanctimonious wailing and droning guitars, then if I were you, I'd go and see Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus, if only because the support group play a cover version of Three Up Into the Year Three, which I just think is fantastic because it proves how old I am, that the band who I still consider to be, you know, young and current and hip for the 5-year-old market have split up so long ago that covering their songs is now considered to be a rock classic. And anyway, there's no bit in the U2 film in which the guitarist, what's he called, the Hedge, throws his plectrum at the 3D camera and it zooms towards the audience. What's the drummer in
Larry.
U2? Larry?
Larry Mullen Jr.
Is that really his name? Larry Mullen Jr. Is there a bit when he throws the drumstick up in the air and it spirals up and nearly clips? I think they're CG.
Because do you know what? If they had done that, you would have criticised them for being cheesy and embarrassing.
Thank you. I've just been given sugar with my... This is bizarre. Thank you so much. Somebody's brought me coffee.
Admit it.
I feel like I've moved up.
If they'd done that in the movie, if they'd done the drumstick thing or they'd done the plectrum thing...
I would have said bravo.
No, you wouldn't.
I would.
You'd have slagged them off for being predictable
and embarrassing.
No,
but you know what? Because they wouldn't do it, because it's not about world peace, man. No, I mean, would the Dalai Lama...
The accidental husband, is it 8?
Yeah, the accidental, not funny in any way or interesting, terrible day. This is one of those movies that gets called a chick flick, and which is, for my money, the most chauvinist expression, because people always describe really terrible, unfunny, limp, anodyne comedies as chick flicks. I mean, no, chick flicks are like I Spit on Your Grave or, you know, Ms. 45, Angel of Vengeance.
Number 7, In Bruges.
Yeah, now... This is
the worst title ever.
Two things here. Firstly, yes, it is a very, very odd title. The film doesn't open here for a couple of weeks, but it's opened already in Ireland, which is why it's come into the top 10.
It's not open here, but it is in Ireland.
In Ireland, but that's why it's...
Is the UK and Ireland.
I know. Clearly, that's the thing. I was going, why is it here? Because it's not, but it's opened, it's played at a film festival, and it's opened, and it's clearly done very well in that market because it's Colin Farrell's in it. And
he's in everything.
He is in everything, yes, but it's quite interesting. It's an interesting film. I can't do it in a brief. I have seen it already, and I've interviewed the guy who made it. But it's an interesting film. But I'm not going to review it until it comes out.
It's not an inspiring title, is it? You
in Bruges,
In Bruges.
But the point about it is, it's about these two guys who get sent. They're criminals. They get sent to spend some time in Bruges, which is meant to be the worst and most boring place on earth, but is also a kind of fairy tale city where they discover, you know, redemption and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's very dark. It's very, very... The guy who made it made a very good short film before called Six Shooter, which won an Academy Award, which is very, very interesting.
Now, The Cottage is at number 6 on this subject.
Yep.
Paul Andrew Williams.
Yep.
Writes a letter. A letter, proper letter, with an envelope.
How else is he going to write a letter?
Well, you know, everything comes from emails.
He physically wrote a letter.
The art of letter writing is dead. The writer and director of The Cottage and London to Brighton.
Mm-hmm. Which I like very much.
Dear
London
Mark,
to Brighton, not The Cottage.
Dear Mark, I'm reading your post.
Yeah.
Just a quick note to say that even though our opinion differs on my film...
The Cottage.
Yeah. I still have you as one of the genuine, uncynical critics in the business. And a credit to boot. I hope our paths cross at some point. As I think that's through gritty
tape. Is there a sting in the tail of this, or is this...
As I really want to discuss South Devon...
Oh.
Now, that's something to meet up for.
Okay.
He says, I'm from Tynmouth. Keep on being genuine, as I'm sure you will be. Deep respect, Paul Andrew Williams, the writer and director of The Cottage. Which I must say, respect to him for writing that after you savaged his movie.
Well, look, here's the thing. When we reviewed London to Brighton... I remember he also wrote in, I think he emailed at that point, to say, you know, thanks, you know, I was very keen to hear what you thought. And here's my feeling about all of these things. For a start, you can't temper what you think about a film in a review. And secondly, the assumption that everybody likes everything, it's just complete nonsense. I think that the only thing you can ever do is be honest. And as that letter demonstrates... most filmmakers worth their salt. If you love their film, they'll take it as a compliment. You hate their film, they'll take it on the chin. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. I mean, as I said, in the case of The Cottage, I mean, Andy Serkis, who I really, really respect very much, said to me, why don't you like The Cottage? And I said, well, you know, for me, it's not funny and it's not scary and it didn't work. There's nothing I can do about that response. But I think it's very stand-up of him to have written that very nice letter. And as I said, I think I did say in my review, I believe he has another great film in him. This isn't it, though.
In Chesham, Mark and Simon, I recently found myself in the rare position of not only having every seat immediate to me being vacant, but the whole flipping cinema.
Where?
As a consequence, I was able to watch an entire film without being distracted by giggling teenagers or sweet packet rustling elderly people. The only thing that ruined the experience was the fact I was watching The Cottage. So I'm sorry, Paul Andrew Williams, who's listening again.
And no such thing as a cheap laugh. Well done, Simon, for lowering the slightly respectful tone of that moment back down into the
slight... But it's in at six, so...
Hey, look, and it'll take money on DVD. I just don't like it. I just don't think it works. But again, what is the value of praise if without criticism?
What?
Because if somebody... Look,
have you not finished that sentence
No,
yet?
But it's like every time you open those papers, it says, oh, it's the best thing I've ever seen. When you say every single thing they say is that, it just doesn't mean anything anymore. You can't just be... Do you understand what I'm saying? You're looking at me like I'm speaking Chinese.
No, I'm just waiting for you to stop, then I can move on to the top five.
OK, I'm just filling...
The bank job at five.
You know, Jason Statham, you stopped me doing my Jason Statham review. And on that YouTube
thing... The other Berlin girl at four.
On that YouTube thing, you've done it again. On that YouTube thing, it says, isn't it funny when Simon stops Mark doing his Jason Statham impression? Because clearly Mark thinks it's really good, but Simon understands that it's rubbish. The other Berlin girl, it's two different types of movie. One is the type of movie with David Morrissey in it, that's a political thriller that's written by Peter Morgan that has some interesting stuff to say about the unholy marriage of church and state. The other half of it is a strange, child inappropriate, bodice ripping, odd, sort of bawdy romp. And it can't quite decide which of those two things it wants to be. And it ends up falling between two stools. And right in the middle of it is Eric Banner, who can't figure out whether he wants to be Eric Banner of Yore, the sort of the chopper figure, or Eric Banner of The Lucky You. And so it just ends up being unsatisfactory, despite all the interesting stuff.
Game Planet 3?
As we discussed before, we're waiting for reviews to come in for the game.
Oh, yeah, that's the one you couldn't be bothered to see. That's right.
I couldn't be bothered with being in Philadelphia on the other side of the world and being 10 movies out this way. But honestly, I just don't keep up. I think you should get somebody else.
Vantage. No, there is no one else. Vantage Point is at number two.
As you know, Simon, it's a modern-day Rashomon. And Rashomon is...
It's a film where you see the same story from a number of different perspectives.
From which country, Simon?
From Japan.
Well done. And which decade?
80s. 70s. No, 50s. 30s. 20s.
Fine. You were 90s? Doing you were doing some. No, you know, you've passed all of the decades now, apart from the... Anyway, yes, fine. So, but this is that, but it's not as good.
Mark says, Simon and the Good Doctor saw Vantage Point this week, and it occurred to me that in the last third of the... Now, someone else has said this.
Oh, go on. It's a bit that doesn't make sense.
In the last third of the film, it seemed to turn into Scooby-Doo.
Yes, it does.
And in actual fact, the terrorists would have got away with it.
If it hadn't been for those pesky meddling kids.
Now, I hope that
there is a bit in it when somebody rips open the back of a van, and that always happened in Scooby-Doo. Somebody ripped open the back of a van, and there was somebody sitting there with a listening device or a remote control that said ghost control.
Here's a Game Plan review. This is Dave in Ealing.
Oh, thank you.
Game Plan is quite funny. It's got a couple of funny moments, but I wouldn't pay to see it. role.
That's okay. That would be advice, most people then.
Advice to the listener then, who was texting in earlier, your son and you will be bored and annoyed that you've wasted your day off. It's not awful though. Well, you can't go and see something just because it's not awful. So the UK's number one is 10,000 BC.
Big, lumbering, stupid. A very good friend of mine, Nigel Floyd, said to me, he said, I heard your review of that. He said, you completely plagiarised my review. I said, I didn't think I'd read your review. And it was one of those cases in which you look at a film and the review simply writes itself. And it is impossible not to say the bit with the emus and Rod Hull. It is impossible not to say it's Apocalypto Light. It's impossible not to compare it to I Was a Teenage Caveman. And in fact, I then did a little bit of research, and it turns out that pretty much those same gags turn up in everybody's reviews, because we all thought the same thing, because it's true. You can't watch people being chased around by a giant emu or emu. There's many of them. What is the plural of emu?
Emus.
I bet it isn't. There'll be octopody.
You need a collective
without
now.
Doing those. So
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I think you know. On behalf of all critics, we're all sorry, but we're all right.
Stephen in Norwich, on the subject of Princess Bride, the book, it does have all that stuff.
Oh,
and
great!
That's the point. The children's film. It's a children's film, but it's an adult novel. Oh. Dan says, "How dare you? The book of the Princess Bride is better than the film, and the whole structure, including the framing device, are lifted from the book."
Well, why? How dare you? We didn't say they weren't.
No, William Goldman wrote
the book. And the screenplay.
And I think, although it's not written like this, he wrote the book after the film. That's that. If I've because I've got the book, and I think I remember that. That's
really?
The order. Yeah, that the film happened, and then he wrote the book as though it was as though
the
it had come first.
That's in the film,
the Princess Bride novel, says Ross, is indeed better than the film, and I love the film. William Goldman elaborates even further on the postmodern fairy tale angle, bringing in elements of legal wrangles, his own fictionalised family, definitely worth picking up. No question, says Jer in Buckinghamshire, that the book version is better than the film. In fact, I would advise you not to read the book, as it will make you realise that, good as the film is, it needs a drastic remake with a proper budget and no rubbish Mark Knopfler soundtrack. I love the soundtrack.
I like Mark Knopfler. He did the soundtrack for Local Hero, which is one of the greatest pop soundtracks ever.
Ian from Ireland. Princess Bride was written by William Goldman, who wrote the screenplay. It contains the very same sentiments, and it's just as good. And I think I'm right that it came after the film.
Somebody let us know that, because that would be very interesting, because in which case that's not a, you know, that's a slightly different case. If the book is a novelisation, I mean, it's rather like 2001. People always think that the film of 2001 is based on the novel of 2001. It isn't. The novel and screenplay were written simultaneously. And in fact, that's the reason why in the novel, they end up going to, is it Jupiter or Saturn? And in the film, they go to the other one, because it's halfway through the production of the film, they started sending back photographs from whichever of the planets it was, and it was too late to change it, but it didn't look like that, so it's different in the novel. But they were done simultaneously.
Is it Spiderwick first?
No.
What will we do first?
We could do the orphanage first. Now, you may remember last year when I was in Cannes, and I came back and said the best thing I saw there was L'Orfinata, this Spanish horror movie, which was produced, now officially presented by Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro made Pan's Labyrinth, which I made little secret of. I thought was just the best film of that year. I absolutely loved it to pieces. And when I saw L'Orfinata in Cannes, it was almost like the next chapter in that ongoing, you know, saga of the reinvention of proper intelligent fantasy filmmaking. It's a terrific ghost story. It's directed by a guy who's his first feature, Juan Antonio Bayona. And the story opens with a woman who comes with her husband and child, about whom she harbours a dark secret, back to the orphanage in which she grew up, with the intention of turning it into a children's home. A couple of things happen. First thing is that a weird woman turns up claiming to be a social worker and asking to speak to her son. The second thing is that the son starts making friends with children who appear to be, or maybe, or perhaps they aren't, imaginary friends who may actually be somehow related to the children that originally lived in the orphanage. And from there, the story turns into this very strange mixture of a very real psychological story and a good old-fashioned ghost story. The touchstones, I mean, I'm not the first to say this, but clearly the touchstones are things like The Innocents, The Haunting, I suppose more recently something like The Others. There's a Jack Clayton film called Our Mother's House, which it owes quite a lot to. It's to do with that classic form of ghost storytelling in which everything is to do with suggestion, everything is to do with creaks and shadows, everything is to do with looking down corridors and seeing people seeing things that you don't actually see yourself. And I know there's this ongoing debate, and it happens all the time, about, you know, in a horror film, should you show or should you not show? And there's no right answer. I mean, Clive Barker once famously said that one of the reasons that he believed in putting monsters right there on the screen was because what he wanted people to do was embrace the monstrous. So when he talks about films like Nightbreed and Hellraiser, he wanted you to see them, because he said, I absolutely hate that school of filmmaking when, you know, for the first hour you see a foot, for the second hour you see a hand, and in the last 5 minutes you see the monster for 3 seconds before it's blown up by an atom bomb. So there are very good reasons for being very, very visually explicit. David Cronenberg would be the same thing. He's talking about visual metaphors in films like Naked Lunch and that sort of thing. But in terms of this classic way of doing ghost stories, in which it is all to do with the stuff that's going in on in your mind, if you can do that properly, it is a brilliant technique. And I have to say, Juan Antonio Bayona does it absolutely brilliantly. This is one of the most rewardingly creepy, chilling ghost stories I've seen in a long time. I saw it in this screening room in Cannes. It was at the, I think it was the director's fortnight, and it was a packed screening. We only just got in. It was like one of those great things where you don't think you're going to get it. Anyway, you end up sitting next to somebody you've never met before. The whole thing was completely packed. And on four, not one, not two, not three, on four separate occasions, this person sitting next to me went and grabbed my arm so hard that when I came out of the screening, I actually had like nail marks in my arm.
And this would be a film critic who's kind of used to all this stuff, would it?
I don't know who it was. I mean, it was just somebody who, because remember, those screenings in Cannes, it may be a member of the public, it may be a film critic, maybe somebody who was Spanish, maybe somebody, I've got no
idea. Did they know who you were?
No, no, of course not. The lights were down. Oh. And anyway, in Cannes, nobody knows who you are. In Cannes, nobody's anybody other than Harvey. You know, that's it. Nobody counts. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. That thing which, when a really good horror movie, a chiller, a shocker, works, that it will deliver, you know, real moments of scare. But the absolute triumph of The Orphanage is that it is an emotional story. It's a story about grief and loss and longing and tragedy. And it was an awful lot to Peter Pan. I was reminded all the way through of, there's a poem, and because I'm a complete Luddite, I only know the poem through that Steven Spielberg movie, AI. And it's that thing about, come away, O human child, to the waters of the wild, for the world's more full of weeping. You know that one?
No.
Fine. Well, somebody will write it and tell us what it is. It's a very, very famous haunting poem about, you know, and it's related to Peter Pan. And there's, as I said, there's an awful lot of this story is about Peter Pan. It's about children and not growing up and, you know, wish fulfillment and people becoming other people. And it's really poetic and it's really heartbreaking and it's really moving and it's really spine tingling. And it's done in just such an elegant way. I mean, elegant is the best word for it. But the thing is that when you say elegant, it kind of suggests that there's no real good scares. It's a little bit chilly. It's a little bit frosty. It's a little bit... Believe me, it's elegant and intelligent and sensitive, moving all the rest of it. But there are four moments in it in which... And it was lovely, because last night I did an on-stage interview with the director in London, and I went back to see the film again. And there's a moment in the film which I had remembered from the first time I saw it as being really scary. And I'd completely misremembered the moment. And the thing happened, and I thought, that's not that scary. And I kind of breathed a sigh of relief. And then the thing which really was scary happened, and I had completely...
Instead of saying that, can you give me some kind of indication what you're talking about? So the thing happened, and then the something other thing happened.
No, I can't, because I don't want to spoil anyone seeing it. No, but the point is...
What sort of thing?
I can't tell you, because then when people...
Animal? Are,
do you know the most hate mail I've ever got? This is related.
Giving the endings of movies away.
No, not the endings of movies away.
The stuff
most,
in the middle.
No, no. People are completely correct about this. I introduced Ringu, The Ring, the Japanese Hideo Nakata film on Channel 4 many years ago. And I said, the moment when Sadako crawls out of the TV screen will really make you... And everyone wrote in and went... Not after you told me it didn't. Thank you very much, you blithering halfwit. And actually, you know what? They were completely right. It was the most valid criticism. I should never have said it.
So I was going to watch that tonight.
Would much rather... No, you weren't.
Pingu
is the one you were going to watch. I would much rather sit here and have you cross but intrigued at what it is that I'm talking about rather than you
Can
say...
Can you not give us any idea at all?
No!
Okay.
But here's what I say. When you go and see, if you go and see The Orphanage, right? When it happens, when the thing happens, it's not the second thing. That was the bit. And
okay.
I tell you, at that moment, I literally went,
if I can't decide,
second time round.
I've got to take my 8-year-old to either Dr. Seuss Horton Wears a Who or The Orphanage.
The Orphanage is a 15.
Oh, okay.
So that's the end of that.
Bill in Cambridge. Just been to see The Orphanage with my 15-year-old
Please
son,
Please tell
Max.
Me you loved it. 15, well done, thank you. Do you notice how he quite correctly
he
pointed that out after
What's
the...
a good parent Bill Thompson
Thank you
Cambridge
very much,
is.
Yes. Please tell me you loved it.
He's going to go up in your estimation here. I'm a big... I'm not sure if it's him or Max. Anyway, I've just been to see The Orphanage with my 15-year-old son, Max, a big Guillermo del Toro fan, so he was keen. Right, so it's his son who's the fan.
Yeah.
Not disappointed at all. Nice supernatural theme. Enough shocks to keep both of us happy. And a satisfying, if downbeat, resolution. The perfect Good Friday film. Okay. Shame they're going to remake it in America. I can't see them doing a good job.
Well, except the only thing I'd say in its defence is Guillermo is going to produce the American remake. Juan Antonio Bayona is not going to direct it. He said that Guillermo del Toro said to him, do you want to direct it? And he said, no. And Guillermo said, good.
Chris on this says, dear Hinge and Bracket, went to see The Orphanage on Wednesday. What a terrific film.
Good.
Genuinely scary, with the fear coming from character and story rather than tedious CGI or gratuitous torture porn. This is the best film since Lives of Others. Did Bracket like it? I think. All right, I'm Hinge.
Oh, I'm Bracket. No, I loved it. I'm Bracket.
And you're Bracket. Jim.
I think we're Flanders and Swan, actually.
Jim. A noble thing to be. Mm. Jim says, Simon and Mark went to see The Orphanage on Wednesday night, thought it was genuinely tense and interesting horror film. Yeah. After thinking about it for a while, after having seen it, I realised it was a far less conventional genre piece than I originally felt. In fact, one could question as to whether it's a ghost story at all. Brought to mind other great horror films of the past, especially Don't Look Now, which to my mind can only be a good thing.
Yeah, there is definitely a reference to Don't Look Now in the same way that there is with something like Hideo Nakata's Dark Water.
Charlie in Cambridge. Mark might be interested to know that there is a musical version of Rashomon set in 50s America at the premiere of Rashomon itself, entitled See What I Want to See. Charlie says, I starred in the European premiere and the part required me to die 5 times, strip a number of times, get intimate with a lady co-star and eat leaves, all while singing. And further proof, if it were needed, excellent, that we have the smartest listeners, Bettina and Joel and many, many others. Bettina and Joel are the two Swiss philosophers, and they sign this, your greatest fans in Switzerland, say that the poem that you're talking about is by Yeats, and it's called The Stolen Child.
The Stolen Child.
And it's a beautifully elegiac poem, says Brian O'Ridden, interestingly interpreted by the Waterboys.
Really?
And Sarah in London also saying it's The Stolen Child by Yeats, and she also says Mark's a Philistine, not a Luddite.
Oh, no, fine. I am both. I think I'm both, actually, because I don't understand computers.
Yeah, Steve, sorry to be picky here, but if you only know a poem from a movie, you're not a Luddite, you're a Philistine. Or a lowbrow, or a film critic.
Yeah, fine.
Kids' movies, holiday films, what have you got?
Well, look, there's two things. There's Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who, which is the latest adaptation of a Dr. Seuss story with Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey played the Grinch in the Grinch.
The Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
Yeah, although wasn't that actually just called The Grinch over here? Was it called The Grinch Stole Christmas?
You're probably right.
I think
the longer title in America.
Because it is about the Grinch. So anyway, here, Carrey is Horton, who's an elephant, who catches a little bud flowery thing blowing in the breeze, and he hears a noise coming out of a speck, and he comes to believe that inside the speck is an entire community, which of course there is. Whoville is tiny and lives inside the speck, but everyone around him thinks that he's mad for talking to a speck.
I am really happy you found this speck, and I'll... But you might want to think about keeping it to yourself.
Hmm? What? Why?
Well, you're talking to a clover. That doesn't look good.
You know what doesn't look good? You talking about the speck like the speck isn't even there. The speck never said anything bad about you. But hey, good luck with your illusion of superiority.
You know, the speck can think anything it wants about me. It's a speck.
Whoa. I see what's going on here. Morton, no matter how tight the speck and I get, the speck could never replace you. I'm only sad that I would have to explain that at this point.
Well, that's awesome, Horton. That really helps.
Just try to keep this to yourself. I'll see you later. Try.
It's Jim Carrey doing that voice that he does again, which kind of always slightly gets my back up. Like, here's the problem.
He's slightly understated, though.
He is, but, you know, it's still him doing that. Like that. And it's a hop, skip, and a jump.
I forgot it was him halfway through.
Did
which
you?
Which is a good thing.
Okay, fine. That's probably the onset of early dementia rather than.
No, you actually started sounding
like him just then. That's very dangerous.
I went to see it with an 8-year-old, which kind of is different, probably.
You saw the film?
Yeah.
Oh,
hence I had an opinion on it.
No, I'm sorry.
I didn't just pluck one out the air.
Shall I tell you what I thought? Or do you want to tell me what you thought?
Take it away, Dr. Yes. What did you think of Horton Hears a Who?
Here's what I think. I think the basic problem with Dr. Seuss adaptations is this. In the Dr. Seuss books, which I have read some of, most of what's going on is to do with language. It's like that thing in The Grinch, you know, little Lucy who was only two, and they were merry very. He does that, okay? It's all to do with, you know, strangely formed rhymes. And the illustrations are really just absurdist realisations of the knots that the language ties itself up in. And the great joy of those books is reading them to your kids because it's the way they sound. And the problem is when you put that stuff up on screen, when you realise it, whether you do it as live action with, you know, costumes and things, or whether you do it in Digimation, CGI, this sort of thing, what you're doing is you're kind of unbalancing the cart. It's basically a linguistic construct first and a picture second. And if it becomes a picture first and a linguistic construct second, it sort of falls apart. And what you're left with, in the case of Horton Hears a Who, is it's kind of quite cute and, you know, there are some funny little bits in it, but nothing of any great substance. Anyway, I thought it was really sweet. In the BBFC report, the BBFC have gotten, they're becoming more and more like film critics, God bless them. After having said it's you, contains no material likely to offend or harm, which is worth knowing at this period.
Yeah, I think
that's
about right.
Absolutely worth knowing. It says at the end, language is very mild, it is a comic feel-good film with many strong positive messages about teamwork, standing up for what one thinks is right, and respect for all people. It's like, that's a review. That's not a. But the problem with it is very, very bland. Now, compare that, for example, to Spiderwick Chronicles, which I think, you know, I don't think it's going to have as big a market. I actually prefer the Spiderwick Chronicles. Spiderwick Chronicles, for my money, is a better movie, based on a series of novels which I haven't read. But John Sayles is credited as one of the screenwriters. John Sayles was on the program a few weeks ago, and of course, you know, he's a really, really great filmmaker. He made his own sort of fantasy movie, The Secret of Rowan Inish, The Legend of Rowan Inish, some time ago. Anyway, story is a mother and her kids mother who seems to be in the process of separating from her husband, as is always the case with these stories, now moves into a run-down, decrepit house which used to be lived in by an aunt who has now gone mad and has apparently been carted off to the lunatic asylum, although of course she isn't mad, because it turns out that when the kids move into the house, the person who used to live there, their great uncle Spiderwick, had documented and chronicled all the fairies and elves that live in the nearby vicinity, and his document had become so authoritative that now all the goblins want to get into the house to get it so that they can take control of the fairy world. So kids, house, creaky stuff, special effects, and what they have to do is to keep the book safe.
Let me guess, the book's got a charm on it.
Lest there fall any more harm on it.
Great. They're not leaving.
I know.
They're never leaving.
I heard you.
Why does he want that book so bad?
I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
All I know is Mulgrath can't break the circle without this book, so we're safe as long as we stay in the house.
Until when? We stay here long enough, we're gonna end up like her.
Wait a minute. She can help us.
Aunt Lucinda, are you kidding?
We don't even know her or where she is.
I think I do. She's at the Woodhaven Sanatorium. But how do you get to her? If you step outside that circle, I'll get you.
Thimbletack knows a secret way. But in the house, the book must stay.
Rated PG for scary moments and moderate fantasy violence, which is obviously the reason it wins my respect. Here's the thing with Spiderwick Chronicles. I didn't go in with huge expectations. I went to see it last weekend because, like Horton, it kind of previewed last weekend and I took my kids to see it. And they really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed it. I thought the story was well told. It's directed by Mark Waters, who made that remake of Freaky Friday, which is very good. He also made Just Like Heaven, which is very terrible. And he made Mean Girls, which is very successful. And it's shot by Caleb Deschanel, who did things like Right Stuff and Passion. And it's what when I was a kid, what I wanted from movies was a good spooky story with an element of threat, an element of tension, you know, edge of your seat stuff, monsters. I wanted happy endings, fine. And you do get a happy ending in this, although it's, you know, it's also a melancholic ending. But en route, you get some quite big, scary creatures. You get two pretty good performances by Freddie Highmore, because he plays twins. He plays one twin who is sort of difficult and stroppy and one twin who is kind of quiet and not difficult and stroppy. And he does that quite well. I mean, he's a perfectly good actor. He's obviously, you know, turning into a, you know, very fine and talented performer. But I just thought it was well done. The thing it reminded me of was, you remember when I famously got Bridge of Terabithia wrong? Bridge to Terabithia.
Yes.
And I didn't like it at all. And a load of people wrote in and said, look,
you're wrong, and you went to see it again.
I went to see it again. And I thought, you know, well, I'm still to be convinced that it's quite as good as some of our listeners thought, but I think I did misjudge it. And this is, some of the reviews of this have said, oh, it's Harry Potter light, because anything now with magic and kids is, you know, you just say, oh, it's Harry Potter light. It's not. It's actually much closer in tone to Bridge to Terabithia. I think it's a better film than that. I thought it was interesting. It was a good, well-told story. I believed in the character. There were a couple of moments that were scary, a couple of moments in which it was, you know, arms around the kids because there was big monstrous stuff happening, and it resolved handsomely. And I thought, you know, if I was a kid, that's the film that I would want to see. The only thing I would say is, for the particularly young end of it, there are bits in it that are scary. I mean, they're comically scary, but they are, nowadays, CGI monsters can be pretty roaring things. But
on that very point, Bill on this email says, Simon and the Doctor, if you're reviewing Spiderwick, please alert parents of small children that it's a PG, but it's really scary.
Well, there we go.
If your kid doesn't like monsters or gets wigged out easily, this movie should be avoided. Bill says he loved it, but it is,
it's very good to hear that it's not just me. Interestingly enough, I think it's not necessarily the younger child who will be scared, because it's to do with idea. There is a moment towards the end, which again I'm not going to describe for you, even though you're going to give me that look, which says, why don't you tell me how it works out, in which actually, the more mature you are, the more scary it is. But I do think it was well made, and I'm very glad to hear him. Did Bill say he loved it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there we go. So that's
Tom in Sheffield, good doctor, Sir Mayo. I had the pleasure of seeing the Spiderwick Chronicles last weekend with my partner and our 9-year-old lad. We all thought it was excellent half-term fare and wondered if you agree with us that Nick Nolte was actually very good in it, as was the entire cast. All in all, a charming, brilliant film in a year where so much has underwhelmed. So
yes, I really, and as somebody who's complained about what's happened to all the great kids' movies, I was really pleased to see it. And I was surprised. I didn't go in with really high expectations. I went in thinking it'll just be a kind of straightforward kids' fantasy, but I thought it was a lot more than that.
A word of warning.
Uh-huh.
This from, well, it's signed, oh yes, it's from David. David Burns. Hello both. I've just seen the good doctor pronounce Meet the Spartans. I've just seen the good doctor pronounce. Anyway, I think what he means is, I've just seen Meet the Spartans.
Oh, I see, fine.
And I think I know what's coming.
Oh, I see, fine. Yes.
I watched the film last week for my sins, and I wholeheartedly agree with what he's about to say. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. And this, just before we get to it, from Charlie in Sheffield. I've just sat through Meet the Spartans. All should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. Worst film of the decade. Mike in Hammersmith, thank you. The collective noun for emus is a brood of, or a mob.
Of...
Emus. Yes, emus.
You know, but I was asking what the plural of them
it's
was.
It's emus.
Is it emus? It's not emui.
No, of course it's not.
Don't say of course, because the words that end in u, when you pluralise them, they tend to do something weird.
Nick Peacock, greetings from Corfu. Question, how can the good doctor argue for the Comsat Angels over Joy Division when he's never heard Fisherman's Blues by the Waterboys, which ends with The Stolen Child? Sorry, but lack of exposure to this album disqualifies you from having or voicing opinions on popular music.
I'll tell you for what.
Treat yourself to an hour of pure magic.
I do have the 12-inch single of In a Pagan Place, with the horns. And that was pretty much all I needed.
Dr. Joe Faith at Northumbria University. Dear H&B, Kermode's inability to understand computers doesn't make him a Luddite. It makes him, at worst, a cretin. He would qualify as a Luddite if you wanted to destroy all computers. Enough! Let's move on and meet the Spartans. Okay. Introduce us.
Meet the Spartans. So, for the benefit of vodcast viewers, here's my brief review.
We're being lively streamed. That was Mark banging his head against
the
table.
Okay, it's a spoof. I love the way they use spoof. It's a parody. It's a crazy, zany take on 300 from the team behind Epic Movie, Date Movie, vaguely behind those scary movies, which weren't funny. Went to number one in America for about 1 hour and then went swiftly to number seven and then hit the number 10 spot before bouncing out to number 16. Anyway, deal is that bloke out of EastEnders is Leonidas. And here's a clip.
Why is my king so restless?
Can't sleep. It's this whole battle of Thermopylae thing.
Are you still thinking about what that young oracle said? There's only one woman whose words you should listen to.
Oprah.
Your wife?
Right. How will I be tried in the court of public opinion?
Well, Harry Knowles at Ain't It Cool News says this movie is just a cheap ripoff of 300. Even if the Oracle doesn't support you, I do. And Sparta does. This could be our last night together. You want to do it?
And yes, the gag is, it's weightlifting, because the thing that the makers of Meet the Spartans have noticed is that the Spartans in 300 are a bit camp. And that's the gag that they have. They're a little bit camp. Now, one of the things people often say to me is, well, how can you criticise? You know, have you ever made a film? Could you do any better? Well, in the case of Meet the Spartans, you know what? I did do better. Go to YouTube, look at our review of 300. Every single Meet the Spartans gag that is in that review, it's shorter, it's funnier, it's free. Sorry, that was it. Took 3 minutes to do the gag about they all look like they're members of the Village People, they all should be dancing down the road to I Will Survive. Fine, boom. That's so. Now, once Meet the Spartans has run out of that gag, because that gag lasts precisely 3 minutes, don't believe me, go and listen to our podcast, they go, oh, well, we have to do something else. So, according to the press notes, in this crazy interpretation, our heroes encounter a host of madcap characters. Madcap. Always beware of madcap. Bearing more than a striking resemblance to some of the biggest names in film and music. So they've run out of Spartans gags, so they bring on somebody who does... Britney Spears, right? She shaved her head. That's really, really up to the minute. Rocky, he talks funny. American Idol, that's Simon Cowell, he's quite nasty. Then the film ends, and then there's a series of credits which say things like George Bush lookalike, Dane Cook lookalike, and you think these people weren't in the film, and then they're not. They're in the 10 minutes outtakes afterwards, and the reason they're in the outtakes afterwards is they are so unlike the people they're meant to be taking the mickey out of. If they didn't appear after the credits, you wouldn't know that's who they were. There is actually two moments in the film, one of which in which somebody is doing an imitation of Dane Cook that is so bad, even though he's been credited as the guy who's doing an imitation of Dane Cook, that somebody actually says, "Oi, you... Dane Cook," and another bit in which somebody says, "Look, it's the fat bloke out of Borat," because if he didn't say these things, you wouldn't know. None of the jokes are funny. None of the jokes are topical. I mean, the Britney Spears shaves her head joke. If Hale and Pace had done that gag the day after it happened, you just about would have got away with it. And if Hale and Pace had done all these gags in the week that 300, you would have gone, well, it's limp and stupid and rubbish, but hey, you know, Two Ronnies is off nowadays, Hale and Pace will put up with. I mean, this long after the fact to go, oh, you know, it's a parody, it's in the mould of Airplane. No, here's the key thing. Airplane, the gags in Airplane came really, really fast. They were really light their feet. Every frame had a gag in it. There was too much to see. If you watch it again on video, it's like the stuff is flashing. In 300, the gag, it's like watching a hippopotamus wallowing in mud. It's like the gag will be set up and then it will put its big flat foot and go squish, and then it'll go bleh, and then there'll be a pause. And the pause is meant to be where the laughter is. And it's like that Vic Reeves thing, that there's this and, you know, a tumbleweed kind of goes through as total, total laugh-free existence. I mean, no, I mean, the movie's like 78 minutes long, including all the credits, and it still feels like you've been in there for the best part of 4 days. And it's cheap and shoddy and badly put together and you know, not funny. And they, I just, this idea that, oh, here's what we'll do. I mean, here's another example. There's a gag in which the opposing army turn up, right? There's only 10 of them, but they turn up with a blue screen, right? That's the gag. But then they go, oh, yes, it's a blue screen. We're going to computer graphically impose the people on the blue screen because it's a joke about blue screen. And then the Spartans bring on their own blue screen. And it's like the mildest, tiny little atom, the Horton Hears a Who thing of is stretched over 10 minutes. And you're sitting there thinking, you know, what could I be doing? I could be filing my teeth down. I could be, you know, I could be doing any number of things that would be less annoying than watching this happening. And they just keep doing the, and you know what? The Spartans are really camp. They do Austin Powers gags. Austin Powers gag. I mean, Austin Powers is like, it was the previous decade, wasn't it? So, it's so not funny. And it's so badly done. It's so cheap. Bad news is, it costs 30 million or something. It's taken 50. That means the sums will add up. If you make it go to number one, they'll do it again. I mean, really, it's so gut-bustingly not funny that, you know, you can't sleep with a clear conscience if you pay to see it.
How unfunny is it?
I'm trying to think of something that was comparable.
Well, gut-bustingly was working for me.
Yeah, I tell you what it reminded me of. You remember there's a line in Hitchhiker's Guide when somebody is listening to Vogue on Poetry, right?
Yes.
And they're
second worst poetry
after that woman who lived in Finsbury Park, right? It is Finsbury Park, isn't it?
I can't remember.
Fine. Anyway, and at one point, the person, he's listening to it, and his intestines leap up and strangle his head because the intestines can't take the poetry anymore. That's what I felt like.
James Reed says, for those of us who missed Mark banging his head on the table as they were away from their computers, could you ask him to do it again, please? My best to you both.
you better not do that too often.
No, honestly, that's what it felt like, doing that for like 78 minutes. God, it was rubbish.
Colin on this. Good afternoon to you both. I went to see 10,000 BC with my son of 15 and his mate. We all agreed it was the biggest load of tosh we'd seen in ages. 10,000 could indicate the number of times you could predict what would happen next. It even had a baddie wearing a black eye patch. A waste of money and time spent I'll never get back. On a brighter note, my son and his mate agreed to tell everyone at school the next day how good it was. For fun. John says, love the podcast. Oh, dear Bootsy and Snudge, he says, love the podcast, listen for years. Tried listening live today, but couldn't concentrate. I need to be in the car. How strange. Beavis and Butterhead, more like Andy in Liverpool. How many more movies, by the way?
Well, I could do Lars and the Real Girl if you give me any time, but...
How long do you need?
I could do it in a couple of minutes.
What else is new?
Lars and the Real Girl, Oscar nominated for Best Screenplay, Golden Globe nominated Best Performance for Ryan Gosling. Story is Ryan Gosling plays Lars, a shy, retiring young man who doesn't have a girlfriend. And then one day he tells everybody that he does have a girlfriend. She's a deeply religious paraplegic who doesn't speak any English. And it turns out that she is an anatomically correct doll. His brother is appalled. They take him to the doctor. The doctor says, hey, you know what? Play along with it. He's got a reason. It's psychotherapy. And the whole community then decide that they will play along with Lars going out with the anatomically correct doll. And they all welcome her into the community, and she becomes a big part of their community. They don't appear to have very much to do with the community, because when she gets ill, she gets to go to the doctors, and the doctor doesn't have anything better to do. And at one point, she gets taken to hospital into intensive care, and the hospital don't seem to mind that she's not a real person. And it's meant to be a lesson about how, you know, we're all a bit, aren't we? And actually, if we just pull together, we are the world, we are the children. And it's sweet and saccharine-y. However, the thing that bothers me is, well, two things. Firstly, it's yet another man-child movie. I hate man-child movies. I hate movies about blokes who are sort of charming because they're boyish and charming, because it's like, there was a whole spate of them once, regarding Henry and Rain Man-y and all that sort of thing. I just find them annoying. Second thing is it just me, or does anybody else think there's something creepy about a sweet, charming love story about somebody who, for who the ideal woman is a plastic, anatomically correct doll who doesn't say anything, and the whole of the community would therefore take her under their wing? So I thought the problem with it was, it's, as I said, despite the Oscar nomination, despite the Golden Globe nomination, despite the fact that it's, I can see where it wants to be charming, I think underneath it there's a problematic misogyny. I think there's a problematic romanticisation of man-child characters. I think it has a credibility gap the size of the Grand Canyon, and I swiftly lost patience with it, despite the obviously good intentions of many of its makers.
That's a bit disappointing then.
Sorry.
They put all that work into it. And
I know.
You just trash it.
I know, but like Paul Andrew Williams, they might write me a note saying...
They might do.
Thanks.
Won't make any difference, though.
No. I once got a note... No, actually, I won't tell you that, because I'll tell you off air.
No, tell us now.
No, I've reviewed...
OK, it's no time. Okay, Tim and Lewis, I'm confused. The Doctor doesn't watch TV. He's just referenced Hale & Pace, EastEnders and Vic Reeves. How is this possible?
Because I did grow up in somebody else's house. You know, when I was young, I lived in somebody else's house. And I have a TV now. I do watch TV. As I said, The Observer, I've now got a... I've got a big TV
and
now.
And the movie of the week would be...
L'Orfanato, The Orphanage. Go and see it, but you have to be 15. If you're under 15, I would say The Spiderwick Chronicles, but if you're easily scared, Horton Hears a Who is... It contains no material likely to offend. But just don't see Meet the Spartans.
Unless you just want to annoy Mark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have a happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.